For no reason whatsoever, I was thinking about my grandmother yesterday. I don't know what it was. I can't remember what triggered it. But I always knew my grandmother as being old. I think I always knew her when she was in her 80s. She was in her 80s for a long time. For more than 10 years, somehow. But I remember whenever I went over to her apartment in New York City, she was always eating prunes. She had this fascination for prunes. And I don't know why this popped into my head yesterday, but I just remember seeing my grandma in her 80s eating prunes. And they were called stewed prunes, which I think are still prunes. I'm not a big prune man. I've seen prunes, but I don't think I've ever put them in my mouth. I didn't think prunes were meant for that. But my grandmother did. She was constantly eating prunes. I remember sitting down in chairs all the time with a bowl in front of her mouth and a spoon. My grandmother was very proper. She would never have a bowl in her lap or on the table. It would be the bowl would be up near her mouth so that nothing could possibly drip on her whatsoever. And she had this tiny little silver spoon, and she would scoop up a little prune and sitting in the prune juice, and she would put it into her mouth. And sometimes they were pitted, sometimes not. I didn't follow it that closely. But she was always eating prunes. And the other thing I remember about my grandmother is that she was extremely skinny. I never saw an ounce of fat on this woman, ever. Even her cheeks were skinny. Everything on her was skinny. She was not emaciated, but never fat. Never a little less than normal, fat-wise. Always skinny. And, yeah. And then I realized the reason she was skinny was prunes. She's always, nothing ever stayed in her body because of the prunes. Every time she would eat food other than prunes, it would just slip right through her ass. I mean, there was no possibility that the food would even be digested because her entire esophagus was lined with prunes. And if you're not familiar, prunes really make you go to the bathroom fast. I mean, I just know this. I don't know much, but I know that. Nothing stayed in my grandmother's body. I think if she had a glass of water, it would immediately drip out of her behind. It would just, nothing stayed in her at all. Prunes. Prunes by Ron Vendam.
On the air everywhere, this is New England Broadcasting.
That was my prune story.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, good night. It's the Ron Van Dam Show.
Hold on tight, things can get a bit weird, if you like that sort of thing.
I have opened up an entire show talking about prunes. Who does this? I mean, I don't remember what my grandmother died from. Probably old age, because she was in her 80s for so long. But if they had done an autopsy, all they would have found inside her was prunes. Or nothing. Or absolutely nothing. This woman doesn't have an ounce of food in here. She digested absolutely nothing. But we did find a prune pit. Can't believe I'm still talking about prunes. If you ever have trouble going to the bathroom, you don't take all those stuff, the chemicals and the things and the tablets. Just eat some prunes, man. It worked for my grandmother. That'd be a great marketing slogan if I ever go into the prune business, which I don't think I will. But if I did, I would call it Ron's Prunes, obviously. They're my prunes. And then the slogan would be, it worked for my grandmother. I think it would be very effective. here. What are you doing here? I finished the prune thing. What more do you want from me? What do you expect? I'm going to talk politics or something? No, not when there's prunes to talk about. Ah, the world of prunes. I bet any amount of money that you did not think about prunes today. You never thought this prune thing was going to happen. It'd be so cool if I had an interview today with a prune expert. I don't, because there aren't any. That's Jason Shaw, by the way, composes music on this show. Thank you, Jason. John Shanahan does our announcing and our comedy writing. Nicole Reed does most of our national booking interview guest things. And she's also the British girl that you hear at the beginning of the program. And then there's me. I just show up for no reason whatsoever, apparently. Well, welcome to the show. Make yourself comfortable. This won't take long. This is like a colonoscopy. I hope you're prepared for this show. Once you've prepared to listen to this show, once it actually happens, it's not as bad as you thought it was going to be. It's like a colonoscopy. Speaking of colonoscopies, why do they give you all that prep stuff? You have to drink all this stuff, and then it cleans your body out. It empties your body out completely. You sit on the toilet like for 6 hours. Why don't they just give people a box of prunes? I mean, hey, I worked it out. One of the, okay, fine. We have a very interesting guest coming up later in the program. He is a television screenwriter, and he's written a book, actually. Many of the television shows that he has written, you may be familiar with. So we'll speak to him and get a little behind the scenes of a television writer. And what happens when you actually sit down and write your first book? That's coming up later in the show. You'll find that entirely fascinating. Sit down with a box of prunes and enjoy the program today. It's going to be a doozy. I don't know what doozy means, but people say it, so I said it too. A piece of controversy came up politically yesterday. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Actually, a couple of days ago. Bernie Sanders, who is running for president on the Democratic ticket, as are 27,000 other Democratic people, all hoping to beat Trump. I don't care who it is. Your mission is to get Trump out of office. I don't care how, what. Apparently, you can collude with Russia, give them a call, see what happens. Apparently, perfectly legal. To accept their hacking and to accept their interference, perfectly legal, according to what I've learned now, according to the Mueller report and a reaction to it by the Trump White House. Anyway, I don't want to talk about that right now. I do want to talk about Bernie Sanders, who in a town hall meeting said something very interesting almost voluntarily, and it's caused quite an uproar. And it shows you that Bernie Sanders also has to be real careful about what comes out of his mouth. As you know, Bernie Sanders is a senator from Vermont. And in Vermont, everybody votes, whether you're a criminal or not. In other words, you can be in jail for murder in Vermont, and you still get to vote for president. A lot of people said, ooh, what are you saying, Bernie? Bernie says, well, I'd like it to be that the way, you know, all over the country, where just because you're incarcerated and in jail, whether it be for, auto theft or terrorism, even, you still, if you're an American citizen, you get to vote no matter what, no matter whether you committed murder, mass murder, whatever the case may be, you get to vote because you're an American citizen. And the immediate response by the public was, whoa, Bernie. Whoa. I may be progressive and liberal, but whoa, Bernie. This ain't going to win you elections, Bern. No, no, no. Feel the burn? I'm starting to feel it, Bernie. Whoa. First of all, the response, even by many Democrats, was whoa. Hold on there, Bernie. hold on now. You're telling me that you can actually be a terrorist who has an American citizenship. You can kill like dozens of people. You can walk into a school and shoot them up, kill kids, kill people. Marathon Bomber was technically an American citizen, incarcerated. You're telling me that this person has a right to vote in this country? Yes, says Bernie Sanders, if you're an American citizen, whether you're in jail or not, you should have the right to vote. Whoa, Bernie, whoa. Maybe somewhere in the Constitution that didn't really think about this stuff, maybe that may be arguable. But as far as you warming up to the American people, whoa, Bernie, this is not going to work for you. This is not going to work. This is going to put you on the socialist front page newsletter. You couldn't say more of a socialist kind of thing, Bernie. Yeah, any independent you thought you were going to grab, I think they just ran away from you. Bernie says, yeah, if you're an American citizen, you get to vote no matter how heinous a crime you act. No, Bernie, when you do something like terrorism, your rights should be taken away from you because you have invaded this country. No, Bernie, you should not have the right to vote if this is what you've done. So, Bernie, now, of course, that's my opinion. I don't think anybody incarcerated should be voting. There are fine lines. If you're in jail because you were doing marijuana and you got caught for a traffic stop, yeah, you should be able to vote. I don't know how you draw the line on what's a heinous crime and what isn't a heinous crime. I mean, we all have different definitions of that. However, if you're in a federal penitentiary or a state penitentiary, I think you've lost your right to vote while you're still in there. Now, if you're released from jail, if you're released from prison and you served your time, yeah, vote, sure. And they say, well, Ron, what about terrorists that have served their time? I don't think there are any convicted terrorists that are released from prison. I think that's a life sentence usually, or pretty close to the point where you can't vote anymore because you're too old anyway. Like, you don't know where you are, kind of too old. I don't think terrorists are ever really released from prison. So I wouldn't worry about that. The real question is, should people in prison be allowed to vote because they're still American citizens? Bernie says yes. I say, uh-uh. You've done something to society. Again, smoking pot is not doing something to society. Selling pot to minors, borderline. Murdering somebody? Yeah, that's not a, you can't vote. I'm sorry. You really hurt somebody there. You really shouldn't be able to vote. So, Bernie, I'm going to give you a nail and some hammers because you're pretty much have sealed your coffin politically here. Now, is this going to go away? Sure, every subject matter does. But is it going to come up again during the Democratic candidate debates? You bet it will. This will be Bernie's thorn. Interesting stuff.
Yes, of course, you could have a podcast show host who's congenial and conversational and talks to you like you're both on the same level and discussing the issues of the day. But come on, isn't having a grumpy old bastard who hates just about friggin' everything way better? This is the Ron Van Dam Show.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I'm trying to find a hobby. I don't have a hobby. Everything I do, I do for fun and profit. I don't have like a hobby where I do something for no reason whatsoever. Some mindless. I don't do mindless things because then it sounds like I'm doing something mindless. People are saying, Ron, why don't you play golf? Why don't you go play golf during the daytime? Play golf. I would, but it's mindless. I mean, what I'm doing is I'm taking a tiny little ball, thrusting it onto the top of a little wooden tee, and then I hit it with a stick. I can't do that. And then I have to wear silly clothes like pastel-colored pants. I can't wear pastel-colored pants. I feel like a clown in Florida. And that's the other thing. Everybody who plays golf talks about retiring to Florida. I don't want to retire to Florida because there's other people there that play golf. No, that's not going to work for me. Well, Ron, why don't you try bowling? I can't. Then I'm taking a bigger ball, and I'm throwing it down a wooden alley. And then pins may fall down at the other end for no reason whatsoever. I can't. I can't do that. It's mindless. There's no reason to do it. Gotta find a hobby. Every hobby that I come up with, I think about how to make money off of it. That's not a hobby anymore. I don't even sleep well. I mean, most people can just lie on a bed and fall asleep. I can't even do that. I'm not good at that. I have to lie there for a while and clear my mind. And it doesn't happen. The only way I fall asleep is if I fall asleep and I don't realize it, like I've been knocked out. Then I watch mindless television shows at 3 o'clock in the morning after I've just peed. I don't do that well. I'm not a good sleeper. I can't even do that. Ron, what can you do? I used to be able to eat really well. I used to sit down and eat stuff. I used to have spaghetti and steak and all kinds of wonderful foods. I can't do that anymore because I'm told that if I do, I'm going to get high cholesterol and I'm going to get fat, which apparently now and then is the case. Well, Ron, why don't you just eat like good foods for yourself? They all give me gas. Everything that's good for me gives me gas. Well, how about fruit? Do you eat enough fruit? No. Why not? Gives me acid reflux. My God, Ron. You can't sleep. You can't eat. You can't do anything mindless. What can you do? I don't know. Nothing. I don't even do nothing well. Sometimes when I'm doing nothing, I stand there and I say to myself, this is pointless. I'm not doing anything. It's a luxury not to do something, but I'm bored. I need something to do. I could never just totally retire. I just stand there in the middle of a room and look around and what do I do? We spend our entire lives looking forward to the day where we don't really have to do anything. We don't have to go to work. We don't have to be at any particular place for any amount of time. We can do whatever we want, whenever we want. Oh boy, I can't wait for that to happen. Then it happens, and you're just standing there. Okay, I have the freedom, but I got nothing to do. And younger people say, oh, I'd find plenty to do. Yeah, wait till you put the shoes on, baby. There's nothing to do. Because as soon as you do something, then you're doing it and you have to show up to do it. and then you've lost your freedom. Life's a conundrum. It is. It is. But I don't take it seriously. It's why I do this. Well, it's an income, and also it's something to do with my head. It is. I need something to do with my head. Yeah. I can't do much with my head. When I have doctors on the show, they say, you've got to exercise your mind. What do you want me to do? Put it on a treadmill? I mean, how do I exercise? No, Ron, do puzzles. Puzzles frustrate me. Well, frustration is working your mind. No, it's frustrating. It's not working my mind. It's driving me nuts. What's the difference between exercising your mind and driving yourself nuts? There's no difference. It's both the same. All right, let's speak to our guest for today. He's a screenwriter and he does all kinds of stuff. And we're going to talk to him momentarily.
You are listening to The Ron Van Dam Show, winner of every international and global podcasting award Ron has given himself. He writes them in crayon, on construction paper. It's actually kind of cute.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Ron. I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. Daniel Robinson is a screenwriter. The screenwriter for ABC's hit television series, How to Get Away with Murder. He's worked on that. Other shows, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, Private Practice. It's a behind the scenes of many of the shows that you enjoy. This is why you enjoy them, because Daniel did them. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me and for that hyperbolic introduction.
Well, you know, you do what you have to do here. But no, it's true, man. Being in the business a little bit, you start to realize, like, it's not just what you see on the screen as far as the performers are concerned, but there's a lot behind it. And a real successful show is one that's written to that extent, and that's great. And we are, you know, the public is very interested in what goes on behind the scenes because it's quite involved, it's quite selective, and it's kind of like Hollywood wonderful to many people. I'm sure to you it's not always Hollywood wonderful.
No, it's definitely not. In the long run, it has certainly been, and I will always be grateful to the city for giving me a career. But yeah, mm-hmm. I'm as close to a company man, I think, as you can get in Hollywood. Yeah. And I came out here, you know, about 13 years ago, and it took me 10 years to break in and really get my career going. And in that time, I was everybody's assistant. I was a producer's assistant, agent's mm-hmm. assistant, director's assistant, manager's assistant. Yeah. I got a lot of kale salads for lunch. I got answered a lot of phone calls, had a lot of meetings.
Yeah.
And so in that time, you know, you're out here because you have to be, because this is where your dream is, and you want to be a screenwriter. And there's no other city in the world you can really do that in, at least not on this level. And so you got to learn to love it. So I have definitely learned to love Los Angeles, California.
Excellent. And interestingly enough, it hasn't stopped there for you, because writing has gone into a little bit of a different twist and a different direction. I understand your first novel has been hitting now.
That's right. Yeah, the first novel's out. It's called First They Ignore You. And it's fiction, it's comedic fiction, mm-hmm. but it's got a lot of my experience over that decade it took for me to break in. It's kind of like Entourage, but like D-list Entourage, right? Without any beautiful people or celebrities or anything like that. The reality of what people experience when they come out to Los Angeles to break into the entertainment industry. And, everybody's sort of playing that game. There's so much ambition in this town, so much ego. And so it makes a really fertile ground if you want to tell a satirical farce, which is what I've tried to do here. And ground that with my, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, is it true what the rest of the country hears, that everybody who lives in Los Angeles, California, is there to break into show business? I mean, is it actually the case?
Well, LA is probably like five different cities in one. So there's definitely the entertainment part of the city, which is like that, you know, and it feels very big when you get out here. The longer you're here, the smaller you realize the community is. Yeah. And you, if you don't know someone, you know, you at least know their friend or someone they've worked with.
Uh-huh.
But, there's a large population of people who live here, who are just born here and live here, and it's a normal American city to them. And then there's a huge migrant population that comes every year, you know, busloads of kids coming from film school, or like, you know, the most attractive person in their town or whatever coming out here to be an actor.
Yeah.
And so there's that community as well. And I think it's to the benefit of LA that there's so much diversity here, because you can kind of build whatever kind of life you want, and whatever you're into, we have it here. But I feel like I'm talking for the Public Tourism Board of Los Angeles now. But it can be overwhelming, too, when you first come out here, because there's not necessarily kind of a go-to culture. There's not one Los Angeles culture. Yeah. There's not one group of things or a group of people that are dominant or that people tend to do out here. And in the book, the main character, Russell Horvath, he's come out here to be a screenwriter.
Mm-hmm.
He's been out here about a year. And he's kind of like me if my career had gotten way too successful way too quickly, because he hasn't dealt with any of the issues that I think all of us kind of have to deal with as we grow and mature, the leftover baggage from our childhood.
Yeah.
And he's got a lot of anxiety and some depression, and it really only gets worse with success, because he only feels more with a modicum of success, right? A small amount really sends him over the rails. And he's developed this binge eating disorder that he's kind of kept secret from everybody in his life. And the book takes place over one weekend. It takes place all over the city as he kind of wanders from place to place, or runs in panic, more likely from place to place, trying to hide the fact that he's been sneaking off to have these, you know, 5,000, 6,000 calorie meals at a time to try to help deal with the anxiety that he's feeling.
Yeah. You know, to the layperson, it seems that Hollywood is a land of dark secrets, a land of performers and people who can't handle the personal stress of putting themselves out on the line, of drug addiction, overeating in this case. But it seems to be like people that can't handle their own deal. People that are just somehow mentally bombarded, like a Michael Jackson thing. Like they're just like not equipped to handle this stuff.
Well, I think yes and no. I think if you look statistically across the country, and it's one of the reasons I was so interested in writing about this particular subject matter, is you see that there's a lot of people dealing with anxiety, dealing with depression, dealing with eating disorders, dealing with addiction.
Mm-hmm.
There's probably, and it's very unfortunate to say this, but not one person in this country who hasn't in some way been affected by addiction, whether it was themselves or a loved one or a family member. It is a big problem in this country. And it's my opinion, it's not an expert opinion, it's just my opinion as a writer who's read a lot on the subject, that, you know, it kind of ties into the work on the show as well. It's a criminal justice show, so you learn a lot about criminals. There's nobody who's there, or maybe there's like less than 1% of the population who's just born bad, who's like a bad person who wants to go out and commit crimes.
Yep.
And it's the culture that people grow up in that produces what we define as criminal behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes these are people who come from a traumatic background, a neglected background, an abusive background. They've had someone else in their family who's been incarcerated. They've been labeled at a young age as somebody who is prone to criminal behavior, whether that can start in the school, you know, just by getting detentions early on, which can kind of lead to a prison pipeline for that person later in life. And so you really learn how much empathy is lacking in this country. And not just empathy from one person to another, but within ourselves as well. How a lot of us are really, really hard on ourselves, harder on ourselves than we would ever be on anybody else.
True.
And so in Hollywood, to bring it back to your question, you know, it is broadcast, right? Everything that these people do is being broadcast to the country. So it can look like, you know, they are overrepresented by definition in the national discourse. But I don't think that the rates of probably drug abuse, alcohol abuse, depression, anxiety, I don't think those are any higher out here, maybe slightly, but not much than the national average. I think it's just that the camera's there rolling, or you know, the reporter is there writing down the story for that particular individual. There are a lot of pressures here on people to be that perfect image in front of the camera always. So that's an extra level of pressure. Yes. But I think increasingly kind of everybody feels that pressure in our society, especially because of social media, to broadcast our lives as sort of perfect examples. So, you know, not everybody suffers from this. I'm not saying everybody has anxiety or depression or addiction or anything like that, but there's enough people out there who do, that to me, it represents something missing in our culture. And so that's kind of what I was trying to, to touch on in the book, is from that empathetic position, tell a compelling story. It's really funny because this guy has anxiety. He's always looking for the next catastrophe.
Yeah.
So when you look for catastrophe, you tend to find them. And if they're not there, you tend to manufacture them. So there's a lot of funny moments in the book. But at the core, it's dealing with that issue of self-love and then accepting the love of other people as well.
Yeah. I've always had a respect for TV writers, and I'm not just saying that because I'm talking to you, because I'm getting no prizes for this. But I'll tell you, it's in writing, in screenwriting, there's an element that you don't find in books, and that is dialogue. You actually have to, when you're creating something, you actually have to put forth the entire thing, not just visual images. You got to throw in the dialogue, and the personalities have to be in the words that are chosen, and they have to be quick, and they have to be interesting and yet deep. And I mean, those scenarios are just, it's like, it's full. That's why I have more respect for that. And I do find that in books, their novels and others that are written by screenwriters, they are that much more involving, because we do get into characters in a more intricate fashion verbally.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute observation. You know, I think Charles Dickens had a room full of mirrors, right? He had different mirrors on his walls. He was a novelist as well, but this was before television. And anytime he'd be writing for one character, he'd assign each mirror to a different character, and he would look into it, and he would act as that character. He'd have a conversation with himself in that character's voice. So it was almost like he was trying to make that person, you know, live with him. And it took me a while to sort of realize that, but you kind of have to do that. You really have to know these people like they're your best friends. You know, you have to be able to become that person. So you look pretty crazy a lot of times. Like, you literally might be staring at a wall, having a conversation with yourself, you know, when someone walks in and says, lunch is here. But you got to do it, because, you know, you have to be a bit of a ventriloquist and find a way to embody these characters. And even I'm glad to hear you say that, because one of the rejections I got from a publisher initially was that it was too much like a screenplay with the dialogue in the book. So maybe that's a good thing if you're the audience.
Yeah, because that's what, that's what throws us deeper into it, is dialogue, man. I love that. And that's why we're so hooked on television programs and movies, because they do throw us in there deeper. Okay. Daniel Robinson, his book is out. It's called First They Ignore You. It's available everywhere, I assume. How can people follow the book and get more information on it?
It's actually only available on Amazon right now.
Okay.
And you can get it, or you can follow us on social media, on Instagram, at First They Ignore You. And we have a lot of cool extra content there, and some quotes from the book, and all the information where you can go and buy it. We got it on Kindle and paperback on Amazon.
Great. Yeah, we all have a fascination about what goes on in people's minds, especially in that particular industry. And there you have it. Hey, Daniel, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Continued success.
Thank you so much, Ron. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Bye-bye. Been a weird show today, hasn't it? You get that vibe? You get a vibe that it's weird? Yeah, I am too. Get that every once in a while. I'm going to be back again tomorrow with a brand new show. I hope that you join me then, because that show tomorrow is going to be even better than this one. And believe me, that's not a tough call. But I'll be here. Will you be here? Let's make an appointment together, okay? My people will call your people. We'll meet here again tomorrow. Any time of day tomorrow is fine. And we'll do this again, but we'll have different things going on. Okay? All right. I like that. Yeah. Yeah. You're my stranger buddy. I don't know you, but let's just leave it at that.